In this part of Focus 580, we'll certainly be talking about American politics, civil rights, race relations. We'll be concentrating on the relationship between African Americans and Latinos. Now, it's very clear, the census figures tell us that now Latinos have surpassed African Americans as the largest minority group in the United States. And the question is, what does this mean for not only for Black Americans, but for all Americans? Our guest is Nicholas Vaca, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in a book that he's written that's just recently been published. It's titled The Presumed Alliance, The Unspoken Conflict Between Latinos and Blacks, and what it means for America. Let me just read a couple of lines here from one of the first pages of the book to talk about what the presumption is. He writes that Latinos and blacks have been exploited and suffered poverty and discrimination, and because they are both people of color, it's commonly assumed that blacks would not only not disparage the new Latino arrivals, but would sympathize and understand the marginal nature of their lives. It was this presumed ideological alliance between blacks and Latinos that he's referring here to a story that a journalist wrote on this very subject, that it exposed this in a very direct and graphic manner. It's something that isn't very much discussed, and we'll talk about why that is. He does go on to say in very direct terms that there is a divide between blacks and Latinos in this country that no amount of camouflage can hide. So more on that in this part of Focus 580. Let me tell you some more about our guest. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He also holds a PhD in sociology from University of California at Berkeley. He's a practicing attorney in the Bay Area and also has been visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley for the past 2 years. His book is published by Ryo, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and is out there in the bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Vaca, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure, we certainly appreciate it. Maybe I should, just to be clear, in my sort of stumbling introduction to the program, I made reference to a newspaper article that offers some evidence, maybe anecdotal, maybe broader than that, about this relationship we're talking about, particularly when it comes to attitudes of African Americans toward Latinos. And this was a piece that was written for a newspaper in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Charlotte Post. And one of the writers, her name is Artelia Birch, went out to get the reaction of African-Americans living around Charlotte to the demographic fact that we're talking about here, you know, the fact that there has been significant increase in the number of Latinos, and everybody sort of expects that if it hasn't already happened, that they will be, they will outnumber African-Americans. So she went out there and sampled the attitudes of black people, and it was really remarkable some of the things that people told her. And including some of the same kinds of racial stereotypes that people said about black people, and here black people were saying them about Latinos. She took a lot of heat for this story, perhaps not because people were questioning the veracity, but people were questioning whether or not it should even have been discussed. And I think it got some of the same reaction to people that you knew when you were talking about writing the book that you have written, that this is just not something that should be discussed.
That's correct. I think a lot of the people that I talked to, mostly Latinos, were telling me, why are you doing this? Why are you simply providing more ammunition to the gringo to exploit both groups? It was the old position of divide and conquer. All you're doing is simply dividing both groups by providing all this ammunition. My response was, look, things have changed dramatically. First of all, this is a reality. It's happening. Whether you want to accept it or not, it exists across the country, and it's something that has to be addressed. And that was really kind of the reason why I began writing this book. I thought that it was important that we explore the differences between the two groups, the conflict, the reasons for the conflicts, and trying reach some kind of a conclusion so that we could move on in terms of the relationships between the two groups. I think that really what startled me when I first started doing the research was the kind of antipathy that existed among Latinos towards blacks and among blacks towards Latinos. The article that you cited was really kind of instructive. To gauge the degree of antipathy that existed in North Carolina and Charlotte when this article was written, I'd like to read a quote from an African-American who was interviewed by Artelia Bush. He said, quote, "I definitely think they are people to fear. They travel in packs. They like to play stupid, acting as they don't understand English when you knew they do. A group of them will sit around and talk to each other in their language. They could be plotting to kill you, and you would never know." I mean, these are the kind of stereotypes that, you know, you would expect perhaps from, you know, some redneck Texan in the southern part of Texas. But this was not the kind of reaction one expected from an African-American to the newly arriving Latino immigrants.
Hmm. Well, I guess I find myself going back to the, you know, the title of the book and the idea that it makes sense, the idea that there should be a natural kind of alliance between Latinos and African Americans for all of those reasons, for the fact that they have they are two groups of people who have all experienced discrimination and should have a lot of not only common experiences but common interests, and for that reason you would think that they should pool whatever political kind of capital and clout they have and work together on the kinds of issues that affects both groups. But so what you're suggesting is that that's, on the face of it, that seems a reasonable idea, but the reality of it is that alliance is not there.
That's correct. It doesn't really work the way people think it should. I think the concept of the Rainbow Coalition is really an ideological concept, very much promulgated by certain groups, with the unfortunate consequences of clouding over the real conflicts that exist between the two groups. The example that I give in Compton, in the Los Angeles mayoral race, in the mayoral race in New York, Houston, and the situation in Miami, all point out that when we're talking about what I call the big ticket items in a zero-sum game, that each group kind of digs in and says, look, we have our own goals, we have our own objectives, and they may not necessarily coincide, if you're a Latino, with an African-American's goals and objectives, and if you're African-Americans, with the Latino goals and objectives. Certainly one of the big examples is the whole concept of immigration, mm-hmm. where Latinos, to some degree, favor immigration more so than do African Americans for, I think, you know, their own reasons and for very good reasons.
Well, I'm just, now that you broach that subject, I guess I'm interested in your reaction and to the extent that you can comment on how other Latinos feel to the kinds of proposals that the president has made that would create some legal status for those very large numbers of undocumented workers here in this country, and a lot of them from Mexico.
That's correct. It's estimated that between 8 million to 10 million illegal immigrants exist in the United States, and of those, between 5 and 6 million are Mexican. And President Bush made this proposal. Now, it has been erroneously called an amnesty program by certain people. It is not an amnesty program, as that program was known in the incarnation of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. That 86 Act really gave amnesty to people who had been here illegally. It led directly to temporary residents, permanent residents, and eventually to U.S. citizenship. Bush's proposal doesn't do that. Bush's proposal is really little more than the Bracero program, which existed between 1942 and 1964, and which brought over 5 million Mexicans from Mexico to work in the United States on a temporary basis, with the intent that once their contract in the United States ended, they would return back to Mexico. It seems to me that the Latino community, as the rest of the community, has been of two minds in regards to this proposal. I think if you want to talk about the leftists or the left-leaning Latinos, they regard this as nothing more than a program that's going to serve the needs of American business and will depress any kinds of wages in the United States. Simply put, what you now have is a program where someone who is here illegally can potentially become legal in terms of getting temporary work authorization and working the job that he currently has because of this new program. If you are in Mexico and you somehow can link up with an employer in the United States, you are then granted this work authorization as well. But the mechanics of that clearly have not been worked out yet. The left-leaning Latinos say, well, look, this is fine for business, but, you know, it doesn't enfranchise them in terms of politics. It doesn't give these group of people the right to become citizens and thus give them the right to vote. The more conservative Latinos say, well, look, what's wrong with that? We had this Bracero program. We know that a certain segment of the Latino population doesn't favor any more increased immigration. What is wrong with this program? It serves the purposes of the people who are here illegally, brings them out of the shadows, gives them work. They send money back to Mexico. At the end of the program, they can return to the countries of origin. What's wrong with that? So really, I believe that the Latino population is of two minds, as is most of the rest of the country.
Is there? Do you think that there is the perception that if this becomes law, then that will it will only serve to increase the percentage of Latinos in the United States? And is there a counter argument that says, well, these people are here anyway,
right,
that it's not necessarily going to increase the numbers? It's just that they're, you know, that there are potential benefits for them and for the United States, yep, to formalize and give them some legal status.
Well, you know, the devil is going to be in the details in this particular proposal. I'm of the mind that I do not think that this proposal is going to see the light of day in terms of being enacted. Mm. I think it's just too broad. I think there's too many issues. I think there are too many interest groups that have goals that are directly opposite to what this proposal makes. The problem with this proposal is that I think that even now, as we are speaking on the radio, you have a significant number of particularly Mexicans who say, look, we know there's a new proposal out there, and that proposal says that if you're in the United States illegally, you're going to be able to get work authorization. And I don't know this for a fact, but I would predict that, in fact, you're going to have an increase in the illegal immigration to the United States, sort of a rush to the border to try and make it here before this program becomes enacted so that they can benefit from it. The other aspect to this program, and just think about this, it says you can be here for 3 years. Now, it allows you to go back as well. That's part of the program. And it's to encourage people to return to their lands of origin. But the problem with that is that there's no prohibition for somebody who comes from Zacatecas to get married to somebody who's a U.S. citizen. What happens then? And what happens if they get married, they have children, and they start creating what are called community ties? And what's going to happen if somebody comes and says, you know, I don't want to go back to Mexico, but I sure miss my family. Do you think for an instance that what's going to happen is they're going to say, all right, well, we're just going to wait till, you know, I eventually become a U.S. citizen, and I'm going to bring my family over here? No, I think what it's going to do is going to result in further increase in illegal immigration. When the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86 passed, I practiced immigration law. And I remember vividly, I would take my clients, mostly farm workers, under what was on called the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, the SAWS program, to the immigration office, and we would do their interview, and they'd come out with a green card. It was a temporary green card until all the paperwork was approved, and they would go out and get the permanent one. The first question out of their mouth was, when can I bring my family? And I would tell them, my God, you just got your temporary work authorization. You still have to get your permanent. You can apply for your family once you get your permanent, but the wait's around 12 years. So you're talking maybe 12, 15 years. Well, I can tell you firsthand that within 3 to 4 months, the family was in the United States living with this fellow who is now here legally in terms of work authorization. I think it's going to lead to further illegal immigration, as did the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86, as did the Bracero program, because I think the solution is not unilateral, but it's bilateral, and that hasn't been addressed yet.
Let me introduce again our guest in this hour of focus. We're speaking with Nicholas Vaca. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. After that, he went on to earn his PhD in sociology from University of California, Berkeley. He's taught at several universities. He's now a practicing attorney and also contributing writer to the publication California Lawyer, and he's devoted the past couple of years to researching relations between African Americans and Latinos. That was while he was serving as visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. He makes his home in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he is the author of a book now presenting some of what he's found as a result of doing this research, thinking, and writing. The book is titled The Presumed Alliance, and the subtitle says it all, The Unspoken Conflict Between Latinos and Blacks and What It Means for America. Questions here are certainly welcome. Questions, comments. Just ask people to be brief so we can keep the program moving and get in a lot of callers. But anybody can call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line. That's good for anybody around here listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana. And in fact, if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to start us off, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
I'd like to make a quick comment. By the way, I really appreciate this show. I think this is a very important topic. First, I'm one thing that the Latino community seems to downplay, and I understand it's partly because there are it's a sticky issue in which if it gets talked about too much, apparently there can be a lot more in the way of communicating with employers, and which could end up with a lot of firings. But what I'm speaking about is the fact that apparently there is within the Social Security Administration as much as $370 billion with a B dollars attributable to illegal immigrants contributing to the Social Security Administration unclaimed, and they don't claim that money. And I really think that every time these conservatives talk about, we don't owe anything to these people, they're draining our assistance programs, for example. You know, it should be pointed out that they've paid in quite a lot, and it's up to, you know, why isn't somebody at the congressional level applying that $370 billion to say, for example, the Medicaid programs out there? But that's a comment. You may want to comment on that, but I have a question I've got to leave, and that is that somebody else on this program mentioned how there's this really cauldron of where there's a lot of activity between Latinos and Blacks in the prison system, and I'm just curious if you'd talk about that and as to whether or not that really spills over into how much that spills over and how much that's shaping this whole thing. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, your caller raised two issues, obviously. The first one was on the Social Security deposits. It's a good comment because one of the criteria that was used during the 86 amnesty program to establish residency in the United States was Social Security numbers and also paychecks. And I don't think in the 400 to 500 cases that I handled during that period of time, I had a legitimate Social Security card number given to me by any of my clients. What they had done was this. They had either gone to a friend, a cousin, a relative of some sort, and said, can I borrow your number? And if the relative agreed, they would use that number. The money would then go to the benefit of the relative. If they did not have a relative or the relative did not agree to do that, they would invent a number. Sometimes the numbers matched up with somebody else's, and they would get a letter saying, there's something going on here, the number doesn't match up. Other times, it may not have matched up. The person may have been deceased. It's unclear why the Social Security Administration did not respond. But this money was being deposited. It cannot be traced because many of these people do not have the Social Security card number anymore. They don't even know what the number is. And therefore, that money, he's absolutely right, it rests, it sits there for the benefit of somebody else, but certainly not for the benefit of the illegal immigrant who was depositing the money as a result of his labor in the United States. It's an issue that has crossed my mind in terms of how best to access that money, what can it be used for, what are the rights of the immigrants who did the deposits, and can they reclaim it? Those are issues that that should be investigated and should be addressed. The other question he raised was that of the conflict in the prison between Latinos and blacks. Christopher Darden, who was one of the prosecutors on the O.J. Simpson trial, has been so concerned about it that he at one time made a proposal that the two groups should be separated because of the incredible violence between the two groups. You see it in such prisons as the Pelican Bay, where I understand it is run by the Latino populace. You see it in other places as well, and frequently you have riots in prisons between Latinos and blacks because right now they comprise the two largest populations in the prisons. It exists there on a very, very, very graphic and violent level. The same kind of difference in conflict exists outside of prison on a more social, political, and economic level.
I appreciate the comments of the caller, and again, there are other people who are listening who have questions, comments, you want to get involved in the conversation. It's easy to do that. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to, you know, the issue of the presumed alliance, the relationship between Latinos and blacks, and again, starting out with this idea, it seems that there should be an alliance given the fact that both groups have experienced discrimination, and that would seem to make sense that they would want to work together to achieve common goals. But then that raises the question of whether or not there are common goals. To the extent that you could speak, certainly you could speak for Latinos, but perhaps also reflect on anything you've learned about African Americans and thinking about all of this. If you look at the issues that would be most important to both groups of people, what are those issues? And are there? And we talked a little bit about immigration, so that certainly might be one. But where are those places that you would say are major points of conflict, places where you would say here is an important issue where African Americans and Latinos have dramatically different goals here, and in fact goals that might seem to be or would be in conflict?
Well, I think one of the areas you have, and I touch on it briefly in the book, is the area of educational resources. There's a description of a town in the South that was traditionally black and white. All of a sudden, you have the arrival of something like 320 Latino students overnight brought in. Their parents were brought in to work in one of the factories. What did that mean almost immediately? What it meant was that since many of these children did not speak English, you had to create a bilingual program. If you create a bilingual program, that requires resources. If some of those resources are drained from existing programs which serve the African-American student population, you have an immediate conflict there. That's obvious. On what I call, again, the big-ticket items, we have the issue of political empowerment. We saw it graphically in the mayoral race of 2001 when Antonio Villaraigosa was running to be mayor of Los Angeles. Now, we had Tom Bradley, who had African-American mayor who had been the mayor of Los Angeles for some 20 years. And Latinos thought, well, it's now our time. And Villaraigosa thought, well, I can get the help and the support of the African-American community. That didn't turn out to be the case. There's reasons for that. There's good reasons for that. There's good arguments for it. But the fact of the matter is that Antonio Villaraigosa thought that he could attract the black vote because he was a minority, he was a person of color, and he thought that, well, it's natural. They should vote for me because my opponent's white. And we know the traditional relation to blacks and whites, and why wouldn't they vote for me? Didn't turn out to be the case. We also have the third category, which I consider to be probably as important, if not more important, than the political arena. and that is the employment area, where you have the continual lament of African Americans, justifiably so perhaps, that as illegal immigrants or immigrants come into any particular area, they take over unskilled jobs, and they do so for the following reasons, so goes the argument. One, they're willing to work for lower wages. Two, they're willing to work in worse conditions than Americans are. And three, they are here on a tenuous basis. Because they are here illegally, they tend not to complain of the conditions because they fear being deported back to whatever country they came from. So I think in these three areas, you have that continuing problem between the two groups, the continuing conflict.
One, I guess, again, going back to the core idea here, there is also the presumption that not only that maybe if we say, well, the fact of the matter is we think maybe it's natural that there be a political alliance, but there's not. Right. That somehow also presumes the idea that we think that for African Americans and for Latinos, there actually is an advantage for there to be an alliance.
Right.
I guess I wonder, though, you know, when you look at, again, you look at demographics, particularly in the part of the country where you are. For example, you present some of these numbers in the book that says that by the fall of 2006, the majority of kids entering California's kindergartens will be Latino. In the fall of 2014, the majority of children entering the state's high schools will be Latino. And by the fall of 2019, the majority of young adults turning 18 and eligible to vote in California will be Latino. If you get to the point where the majority of the population of California is Latino, at least as far as politics there are concerned, will Latinos care what the relationship is between the Latinos and African Americans?
Excellent observation. Excellent observation. It's an issue that I have been pushing during the interviews that I've had, and it's subtext of the book. And really what that says is, look, African-American community, if you do not deal with this and you do not work with the Latino population and resolve whatever difference may exist, there's going to come a point where it's not going to matter to the Latinos, because the Latinos are going to have the power to act on their own. That potentially can happen in Los Angeles. The voter registration level in Los Angeles is raising on a yearly basis, and there may come a time where Latinos will say, you know what, we don't need a coalition. We can do this on our own, or our coalition is going to be with the, you know, liberal segment of the white population. So, you know what, we don't really need it anymore. And if we don't need it anymore, you know what, it's okay, because we're not going to act on our own. Since we were not helped in this process, we have no obligation, we owe nothing to anybody. So now we can act towards our best interest without any concern for any other group. I think it is a real dangerous proposition for the African-American community not to address this issue and not to look at it, because you're absolutely right. If this can happen in California, and it can happen later on in other parts of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have several questions, I promise. I want to make sure these folks know that they won't... I won't make them wait forever. Several callers. I mean, just one further question, though, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I think some people would hear you and say that and believe that what you're saying is that the only group in this relationship between Africans, Americans, and Latinos, the only group that has anything to lose are the African Americans. Do you think that in fact Latinos have something to lose if they have no relationship at all with African Americans?
I think what they have to lose, really, is a sense of perspective and towards the African-American population. People have asked me, says, well, you know, Latinos really don't have any respect for, don't think that African-Americans suffered. I said, no, that's not the point of the book. The point of the book is that Latinos realize that has happened. But Latinos were not participants in the lynchings, they were not participants in the Jim Crow laws, they were not participants in the discrimination and prejudice that existed against African Americans, because we had no power, we were not empowered. Now, it may have happened, but if we had power, we didn't have power. So we have no, in this law we call it liability, we have no responsibility for it, because we just didn't do that. So we come to the table of race relations with really a different background than do Anglos. I really think that that's an important issue, you know, to be considered.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. We're moving into about our last 20 minutes. I have callers and we'll get right to them, but I do want to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Nicholas Vaca. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He also has a PhD in sociology from University of California, Berkeley. He's now a practicing attorney in the San Francisco Bay Area. He has written for the publication California Lawyer, and for the past couple of years has been researching the topic of Black-Latino relations while he was serving as visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley. And he's produced a book that deals with the issue. The book is out now. It's titled The Presumed Alliance, The Unspoken Conflict Between Latinos and Blacks, and What It Means for America. Rayo is the publisher. That's an imprint of HarperCollins. So if you're interested, it is out there in the bookstore. And now we have several people here to talk with, and let's get right into it and talk with somebody in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you might talk about Latino religious conversions from Catholicism to perhaps Pentecostal denominations or other Protestant denominations or to Islam, whether it be Nation of Islam or more Orthodox Middle Eastern Islam, and whether any of those conversions take place in prison, and whether, for example, there is quite a bit of conversion to Islam in prisons. Are those people then out of the gang fights? Are they involved in the gang fights?
It's a little far off the focus. I don't know if Mr. Vaca, you have something to say about that?
No, actually, I don't have much to say about it. It's not an area that I research, but I do know that in New York, where you're having an increased population of Mexicans coming into New York, the sway of the Catholic Church has lessened significantly, and that you're having more conversions to the Protestant religions than you have normally to the commitment to the to Catholicism. That has happened. I have no figures and no information on whether there's been conversions in prisons, whether one becomes Muslim or not. And and frankly, I don't know that much about in terms of the actual tribalism that exists in the prisons, but I do know that Christopher Darden was very concerned about this to the extent that he suggested that the two groups be separated before they be put back into prison.
And what do you think the reason for conversions out of Catholicism is? Is it a way of becoming American? Is it a way of rejecting the past?
I think it's part of the assimilation process. I think that there's been the argument made by many individuals that Latinos don't assimilate. Linda Chavez has a different perspective, and others have a similar perspective. I happen to believe the assimilation of Latinos has been going on for years. I see it in not only my family, but I see it in relatives, and I also see it in some of the students that I went to graduate school with. The problem we have with Latinos is that we're right next to an unlimited source of immigrants, so that as one group of Latino immigrants moves out of the barrio, you have a whole new group coming in and moving in and replacing it. So to the person outside of the barrio, it says, well, geez, nothing's really changing. They're the same. But there's a book by a fellow named Victor Hansen called Mexifornia. I don't know if you're acquainted with it, but he talks about the process of assimilation. He happens to have kind of a mixed perspective on it, but he points out that in the town of Selma in Central Valley of California, he sees that, the police officers, the firemen, the teachers are Mexicans or Mexican-Americans. On the other hand, he also sees Mexicans who are still immigrants here in the United States. I happen to think that the process is an ongoing process and assimilation happens, and so this conversion to Protestantism by certain segments of the Mexican population in New York and probably other areas is nothing more than an example of that kind of an assimilation.
Okay, thanks.
All right, let's go next to Charleston, line number four. Hello.
Yes, the question may seem odd, but perhaps your guess, and I can start with this, why do populations migrate?
Okay, well, I mean, the obvious answer for the Latino population is economic.
Economic, all right. And then, since that is the basis, when it's economic, now we're talking about the basics of life.
That's correct.
Okay, then what creates the shortage of the basics of life?
Well, I mean, for me, and I point out in the book that it's the Mexico's inability to get its economic house in order, the political chaos, whether you're talking about the revolution of 1910, where you're talking about the crash of the peso, whatever, Mexico, for reasons that are certainly obvious to other people, but I have not investigated significantly. That just cannot get its house in order, and therefore what someone can earn in the United States in a month is significantly greater than what someone can earn in Mexico.
Yes, and since 2% of the world's population lives in the U.S., and consume 50% of its good, then this is a magnet, is it not, for third and fourth world populations to try to get where the comforts of life exist.
Absolutely.
And grant that. Okay, then we have to go to the, leave the economic and go to the political and the political economy of what drives these migrations and the desires of people. Now, how is it that the house in order in Mexico, say, cannot be accomplished? And can you explain that?
No, I can't, because that really is something, an area for an economist, a political historian that has studied Mexico. I do know that there is the concept that there are, I think, 10 families in Mexico that control Mexico and have very little interest in the kinds of economic improvement for the working class that we have in the United States. What is real curious about the immigrants who come from Mexico is they're all campesinos. I mean, I don't know how many of the clients that I had when I was doing immigration would come in, and I'd have to ask them what their educational level was. And they'd always say, well, I finished the primaria. The primaria is grammar school. And I thought to myself, in this day and age, isn't it amazing that Mexico is still unable to create a compulsory educational system that forces its population to complete at least high school? Many of my clients were illiterate. You know, it was incredible, and that is really a lot of the population that's coming from Mexico to the United States.
When the 10 families then place the majority of the population, which would be 99.9, in Mexico, say again, for example, that sort of absolute power then creates all these problems. And the object of my questions are that capitalism in its feudal state, that's the way the lands, you know, throughout history, when you have an oligarch, little group who control all the levers of society, then the very things that you're speaking of come into existence. Now, when the Latino are exceeding the blacks who come to the U.S., there again you have another, blacks are further away and less able to get to the shores of the U.S. or where the food is. It's like vulturism. You know, wherever the dead body lies, so, and I think it even speaks of this in the Bible, there where the eagles gather. Well, if those who are here, those who are trying to get here, and the whole corrupt capitalist system that we all sit perched upon and seem almost unable to do anything about it, which therein lies the solution to the problems that you have addressed and things that I have tried to point to. And until we change that paradigm, then we are doomed to all the interracial wars and on a world scale and the ugliness that besets humanity in these modern times. If we don't address that basic question and change that, then all we can do then is write books and give lectures and make phone calls and all the other things that go towards just pellets hitting the wall and ineffectual. Thank you for your time, sir, and I'll ring off. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I don't know if you want to make any further comment on that, or we just want to go on to somebody else.
Well, you know, my concern for the last, I'd say, 5-6 years, and certainly while I was doing the research on this book, really suggested to me that two things were going to happen. One, stopping illegal immigration on a unilateral basis was going to be virtually impossible. Whether you're talking about Bush's work guest program or whether you're talking about a national amnesty program, the fact that you have Mexico as this third world country next to the United States is going to continue to create illegal immigration. There is something in Mexico called the Consejo Nacional de Población, which is the Mexico's National Population Council. And they're predicting, without unabashedly, that Mexico was going to continue to produce illegal immigrants in the United States over the next 20 years. I think their numbers, I have them in the books, I don't have access to them right now, but I think it's in the millions. And they say this unabashedly. It's going to continue to happen. We're trying to resolve the whole illegal immigration problem, which affects not only African-Americans, but by the year 2050, Latinos are going to be a quarter of the U.S. population. We're trying to resolve this issue on a unilateral basis without making any demands on Mexico. I'm continually stunned by how Mexican government will make demands for the protection of its illegal immigrants in the United States, but would not afford them the same protection in Mexico. And I'm more astounded how Latino politicians don't turn around and say, well, look, you know what, we'll help make concessions in terms of immigration reform and the like, but you know what, we need a quid pro quo from Mexico. We need something from them to help stem this tide, because unless we do something in Mexico, things are going to continue.
We have several other callers here. We'll go next to Coal City. This is line number two. Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to say was that the Social Security system was made for American citizen under the Roosevelt era. It wasn't made for foreigners, and, you know, it was made for Americans. Until they become legal citizens, the Social Security system was not made for them. They will bankrupt the Social Security system. The second thing is that you're absolutely right. We have to do something about illegal immigration. By President Bush giving them amnesty is the wrong thing to do. They say we're under terrorism. You know, with the worry about terrorism, they could come straight up from Mexico. I have no idea why we're not guarding our borders. But something's got to be done. And that's about all I got to say.
Okay. Mr. Baca, you have comments?
Yeah. Well, I mean, guarding the borders is a great idea. It's a great concept. But it doesn't work. I mean, it's a sieve. It has been a sieve since the turn of the 1900s. It's been a sieve. It's been a sieve since 1848 when, you know, Mexico lost all of its territories in the southwest of the United States. I love the visual image of people say, well, we got to seal the border. You know, in my mind, I get this idea that somehow you can actually put a big piece of tape right across that border, and it's sealed. Now nobody can come across. It's not realistic. It is virtually impossible to do that. We're talking 2,000 miles of very ugly territory. And the idea that you're going to be able to seal that border, I think, is absolutely unrealistic. You have to stem the flow from the countries of origins. And then perhaps you can have a better control of the borders. But to actually be able to seal it, I think, is virtually impossible.
Let's continue. We'll get our next caller, somebody here who was on cell phone, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you. I'll take as short a time as I possibly can here. I think one of the things that when we're talking about getting back to the topic, when we're talking about the relationships between Latinos and African-Americans, I think that's practically irrelevant when we're concerned about what we should be concerned about is the laws to protect racists against racists. It sounds to me like the Latinos and the African-Americans and the whites were worried about the racists within those groups rather than the people who are trying to get along. And the thing that we need to worry about is maintaining our Constitution and the laws that guarantee the rights of all people, rather than trying to say, well, how can we get these two groups together? How can we get these two groups of races together? That seems to defeat the purpose of our Constitution and what we're really about. And we should really try to protect the rights of all people.
Well, go ahead.
No, I think that's right, but you know, the purpose of the book was really to examine the conflict that exists between Latinos and blacks within the...
Well, the conflict exists, if you ask me, because these two groups are racist against each other. They're looking at each other by their national origin. They're not looking at them as people. They're looking at each other as that racial group.
And that may be true, but that's the reality. And that's really what I wanted to point out, because the assumption was that, in fact, this is not the way they looked at each other. So, I mean, your observation is the correct one, but it's something that has to be pointed out.
Well, then my question is, how do we get to the point, then, if not through law and the protection of our civil rights, how do we get to a hope for the future? Are we just going to get two groups of with the white racists over here and Latino racists over here, and then they can all kind of fight it out. You know, I'm really concerned. Do you see any hope for the future?
Well, you know, posing the questions is far simpler than coming up with the solutions, I can guarantee you that. And I have been asked that same question by African-American journalists. I mean, what do we do in terms of getting this thing resolved? And my response is always, well, you know, you have to create a dialogue on a national level. Look, there's no doubt that you're going to have these conflicts on a local level as well. But I think what you need is an umbrella discussion, a discussion at an elevated level that can filter down to the local level, in which, you know, issues are addressed which are significant to both groups. I was asked on a program recently, well, what do Latinos think about reparation for African Americans? Well, you know, frankly, I don't know. I don't think that question has been asked from Latinos. But I was told that for some African Americans that is a litmus test, that if Latinos say, no, we're not for reparations, for whatever reasons, good, bad, or indifferent, that can potentially close down the dialogue between the two groups because that is such a significant issue. I don't know, but it's certainly something that has to be discussed with all of its ramifications, because Latinos may come up and say, well, look, you know, during the late 1920s, after the Depression, you had massive deportations of Mexicans back to Mexico, many of whom were here legally, but you had this deportation. They were there because the jobs were lost and there was a real impetus to get them out of here. Are they entitled to reparations? Those groups, those are identifiable groups. Can you do that? And, you know, I think that one of the issues is that it's what I call, what has been called this plane of the hurt or the injured card, that is to say, which of the groups has suffered the most in the United States and who trumps who. And I think we have to get beyond that. And I know for the African-American community, that's a real hard issue to overcome because of slavery, Jim Crow law, and the like. Many people still argue that it's, you know, discrimination is much more rampant against African-Americans now than it is against Latinos. But it's certainly an issue that has to get discussed on a national level.
Hmm. Well, I guess just to take the question of the caller just one step further, or maybe just where he left it. Some people might say, you know, if African Americans and Latinos can't manage to work together for their common interests and have some sort of respect for one another, then what hope is there for this country to be a kind of real functioning multicultural democracy like we talk about wanting to have, where everyone has equal opportunity and everyone is respected and we celebrate differences and, you know, all those sorts of things, all those nice phrases that we like to talk about. What hope is it of actually achieving that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know that, first of all, I don't know that the kind of harmony we're talking about, one, is possible, or two, is even something one should really reach for in this sense. The conflict that exists between groups is not restricted to Latinos and African Americans. It exists between Italians and Irish, Germans and Irish. It has existed throughout the history of the United States. What has happened is that people overcome that, and we move on. We live under a rule of law in the United States, and I think to the extent that the immigrant groups can come to the United States and embrace that as rule of law and as the governing and overall structure, then I think we function within that with some kinds of conflicts, some problems. I mean, but we're not looking at massive race riots. We're looking at conflicts that exist on a real basis, but on a local basis frequently, sometimes on a national basis. But we're not talking about, you know, like I said again, race riots. Somebody asked me that question. We're talking about conflicts within what I consider to be the democratic principles and the rule of law in the United States.
Well, we are at the point we're going to have to stop with much more that could be said and some other callers, but we've just used our time. For people who are interested in thinking some more about this and reading more about it, I suggest you look at the book we've mentioned titled The Presumed Alliance by our guest Nicholas Vaca. With background in sociology, he is a practicing attorney in the Bay Area and has also been a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. That's where he did a lot of thinking about and research that went into this book, Presumed Alliance. So it's out there now in the bookstores. And Mr. Vaca, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on your program.